People who should be tested for COVID-19 are those with or without symptoms who have traveled to an affected area with COVID-19 or have had close contact with a person who has been confirmed with COVID-19. Please notify your healthcare provider by phone if you believe you could have it. Call ahead so you can be safely evaluated to prevent exposing others. For more information about COVID-19 testing, please visit the CDC Tests for COVID-19 website, which is cdc.gov/coronavirus. For KZFR 90.1 FM, I'm Matt Fidler, reporting from Chico.
This is KZFR 90.1 FM, Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Today we have two interviews. The first one concerns water problems, particularly related to Shasta and Oroville dams. The second one is about an upcoming holiday celebration in our area. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR listeners and by the COVID-conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets Wednesdays at the North Valley Plaza, Saturdays in Chico at 4th and Wall. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets have been bringing food lovers and farmers together since 1980. And we want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, or programmers. We'll open with an interview that we call Damnation. We're on Zoom with Ron Stork. He's Senior Policy Advisor, Friends of the River in Sacramento. Ron joined Friends of the River as Associate Conservation Director in 1987, became Senior Policy Advocate in 1995. He's a national expert in flood management, federal water resources development, hydropower reform, and wild and scenic rivers. A couple of years ago, we spoke with Ron about the raising of Shasta Dam. We'll ask him about that tonight. But first, we'll talk about something closer to home, the state of the Oroville Dam. Welcome, Ron Stork.
It's good to be here.
So, in early November, the Department of Water Resources released a self-study of Oroville Dam. Their press release said its findings generally agree with those of an independent review board and a regular five-year review by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They, quote, that bothered a lot of us. They said, although no unacceptable risks were found, there are several potential vulnerabilities. DWR said work is underway to address some of those. At this end, we were highly suspicious of that acceptable and unacceptable problems. We'd like to get your take on that report, please.
I got appointed to an ad hoc committee by the Department of Water Resources, the owner of Oroville Dam. Over the last year and a half, we've had the opportunity to look at the formation of the comprehensive needs assessment. And it's a thoroughly mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. Tell us. We know they were full of self-praise and assurances.
Correct.
Tell us about what is not reassuring for those of us, especially those who live below the dam.
Well, they did a dam safety review that we are informed by the independent review board of experts that could look behind the scenes, that was pretty thorough and pretty exhaustive. And we can talk about the stuff they caught and the stuff they have already completed. But your question is, well, what did they miss? There are two big things they missed. And one is that the reservoir design flood, that is the size of the volume of water that Oroville is designed to successfully handle in a flood is dependent on the upper end and the higher flows, fortunately never yet been experienced, for reservoir surcharge. Essentially, the water rising above the level of the reservoir and pouring over the ungated spillway that nearly failed and caused the evacuation of 188,000 people in the Feather River Basin. That that issue was never discussed in the public draft of the comprehensive needs assessment. There was no mention of the reservoir design flood, no mention of any commitment on the department to continue to meet that flood control obligation and duty to the residents downstream. And of course, no recommendation in the comprehensive needs assessment to find a way to keep the hillside from pouring into the channel downstream and causing considerable havoc, including shutting down the powerhouse, and, you know, which is kind of the only way out once the reservoir is dropped to a certain level. So they do suggest that it's a good idea for them to look about fixing this problem that isn't identified as a problem in the future, in competition with all of the other needs of the State Water Project. So, in effect, the folks at Oroville could be in competition with, say, reconstruction of the state aqueduct, which is sunk because of overpumping by farmers along the aqueduct, including farmers who are State Water Project contractors. So this notion of we'll consider it in competition is a disturbing one, at least for North State folks, I would think.
There was also the other big issue that they would undertake more cost-effective projects prior to some of the Oroville dam needs. That raised my ire, thinking that it sounds like they're putting dollars in front of safety. And we know that dollars flowing in from Southern California are more important to DWR's resources than money coming from the north.
Of course, we don't know in the public draft of the comprehensive needs assessment, you know, how these projects will compete. I have my hypothesis about that, and it's actually fairly disturbing. It suggests that they may never get to fixing this problem. Mm-hmm. But I have had a recent conversation with the director, who has promised that she's going to look at this with sharpened attention. So that's useful, but the report itself is disturbing. The other issue that wasn't in the public draft of the comprehensive needs assessment is also a huge one, and that is that the standard way in which you size spillways in first world countries, and even in developing countries, is to identify a extremely large flood event that's never, in general, ever happened before, but for which is very remotely, but still conceivable. And that's called the probable maximum flood. And it's the standard, at least if there's dam safety concerns, if there's a dam failure, and there certainly would be if Oroville failed, to build a spillway that can handle the expected size of that flood. Once again, no discussion about that in the comprehensive needs assessment or in the ad hoc committee that we attended. Other than we'll get to it in the comprehensive needs assessment. Well, there's no discussion about the comprehensive needs assessment. And the it being that we have seen correspondence between FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, one of the regulators and the key regulator of Oroville Dam, and the Department of Water Resources, noting that there apparently is a new estimate of the probable maximum flood, presumably because of either some recent past experiences in flood hydrology or some projections that things could get worse in a warming world, that the spillway is 120,000 cubic feet per second short of what it should be, and also that if used, that is the emergency spillway or auxiliary spillway, the secondary spillway up there, if used, the concrete that's been poured could be expected to experience moderate to severe damage. Now, this is just discussions between FERC and DWR that somehow or another leaked as public information in FERC's email or e-library. And once again, no discussion about that. And there are consequences to having inadequate spillways. Most licensees who have an inadequate spillway in recent years, FERC has been telling you got to fix it. It'll cost some money, but it's your responsibility as a dam owner to meet the kind of standards that we have in the first world. And it's a bit disturbing that that at least in the comprehensive needs assessment, there's no fessing up to that identification of that problem or fessing up to any responsibilities to meet that standards. So those are two biggies.
I want to get clear on what you said about the concrete that you referred to earlier on the supplemental spillway. Is that the fresh concrete that has just been put down by Kiewit Construction since the 2017 episode?
Yes. There's two concrete jobs. One is the concrete job on the main service spillway, mm-hmm. which is likely to be quite competent. They learned by their mistakes and poured an expensive foundation, and they have a much better spillway there. And the emergency spillway got some attention too, or really what should be called the auxiliary spillway, because it has to be used in order to contain a reservoir design flood, a flood control flood. And essentially they lined the hilltop with some concrete and then built a cutoff wall at the bottom. And that's more likely to resist eroding back into the lip of the spillway and therefore fail part of the reservoir. But of course, it doesn't stop the hillside below it from crashing into the river. And FERC's remarks in correspondence with DWR were that they expected there to be some degree of moderate to severe damage if used. That is the new work below that auxiliary spillway. Now, we don't have any details on that. And one of the reasons why we don't have details is that in spite of the rather obvious observation that an inadequate spillway is not something that a terrorist can take advantage of, because it's kind of, you know, it's dependent on nature to generate the flood that would require its use. And that's really beyond, I mean, terrorists don't have control over Mother Nature. But nevertheless, it's most of that correspondence is hidden behind what's called the critical energy infrastructure information, and otherwise known as CEII in the business. And so the public, i.e. me, including the ad hoc committee, don't have access to that information.
I'm thinking, too, that the auxiliary spillway should be renamed, because, in fact, in the event that the lake is filled to the brim, it's the so-called auxiliary spillway that saves the day. So it might be considered the primary emergency exit.
There's essentially two spillways up there doing the job of three. And there's the main service spillway, which is, you know, used routinely every 3 years or so on average to release flood flows that can't be released by the powerhouse, which can have its own problems. Mm-hmm. Some of which have been fixed and some of which may not have been fixed. Then there's that secondary spillway that almost failed in 2017. And the first half of that spillway, as in the height of that spillway, is devoted to, at least according to the Corps of Engineers flood operations manual, is to be devoted to maintaining a regulated release of no more than 150,000 cubic feet per second out of Oroville so that it stays within the levees downstream. Mm-hmm. And so it's essentially an auxiliary or secondary flood operation spillway. And then the top half of it is to be used essentially when Mother Nature has thrown against you such an extraordinary flood that you have to use it for dam safety purposes, mm-hmm. that you're no longer protecting the levees downstream, but you're making sure the dam doesn't fail. So FERC has actually asked the department to reclassify that from an emergency spillway, which implies that third function, to auxiliary spillway, to emphasize its function as a flood control facility. Mm-hmm. But the department has resisted, apparently, and still calls it an emergency spillway over FERC's recommendations. And still fundamentally, there's, you know, this hillside downstream of the hilltop concrete, which although is a better circumstance than we had in 2017, is still not a great circumstance. If that thing is used to any significant degree, there's going to be a lot of havoc from the hillside washing into the channel downstream.
Mm-hmm. So what are the steps that would be taken next? As a citizen, I'm feeling pretty helpless here. FERC is apparently looking out for it. We have to trust DWR to some extent. We can trust Friends of the River to keep an eye on it, and we appreciate that from you. But are there things we can do to protect it, to register our protest, or to keep an eye on the reports that are coming forward and making sure that they are sound?
Well, what Friends of the River and a few other environmental groups can do is to, because we're parties to the licensing proceeding, we can write FERC identifying the deficiencies of the comprehensive needs assessment. And we'll do that as soon as I get a bit more time. Of course, some help would always be helpful. But also, cities and counties and their public works people and their attorneys may have a little more people power than the environmental groups do, and could also make some similar comments. So talk. This has not hit the newspapers yet, in part because I haven't had the chance to write my critique of the comprehensive needs assessment and provide it to FERC. So, at this point, all you have in the newspapers and in the press is DWR's self-congratulatory announcement of the comprehensive needs assessment completion.
I've been a little shocked. Our local paper ran the original press release, but there's been hardly a murmur since then. I wrote a letter to the editor asking people if they feel comfortable having DWR be its own self-assessor. One of our county supervisors called it the fox guarding the hen house. But there has not been the outrage locally that I had anticipated.
Well, this is a somewhat specialized field. Mm-hmm. A lot of the information that would be helpful for people to understand what DWR has accomplished, what it intends to accomplish with a high degree of certainty, and then what it is thinking about accomplishing with anywhere from medium to very little certainty, that requires some press people to have followed the issue closely and to have have some sources who have also followed the issue carefully and kind of understand what's going on, either in front of us or behind the scenes. And that's a fairly small group of people. But the press has, I agree with you, I think the press has missed this one.
Hmm. Will your critique be up on the Friends website and or available elsewhere?
Yep, when I get it done.
Okay, great.
Hopefully it'll be done in a couple of weeks.
Okay, great. And again, thank you for keeping on that. I wanted to switch topics a little bit. Another equally disturbing press release came out from the Trump administration a little bit later in the month, saying, in a sense, they're going ahead full blast with raising Shasta Dam. The press release that I read was filled with congratulatory and self-congratulatory stuff, all from pretty conservative Republican Congress people. The phrase that caught my eye is that there's an abundance of water in the North State, and now this will be good for the environment, good for the economy, good for farming. I'm skeptical of all that. Tell us, please, what have they done, and what are the objections and the next steps in resisting the raising of Shasta Dam?
Well, first of all, let me puncture a balloon in the congratulatory comments.
Good.
With regard to how raising Shasta Dam is going to bring all this cornucopia of water to the parched fields of Bakersfield. According to reclamation, it's expected to deliver 51,300 acre feet of new deliveries on average. That project delivers 7 million acre feet a year to the Central Valley, mostly farms and a few cities. So, it's kind of small in comparison to that 7 million acre feet number. So, for $2 billion, you can increase the capacity of the project by well less than 1%. Anyhow, that's the context story.
Yes.
But what has happened? Reclamation decided to do a supplemental EIS for two reasons, two major reasons. It completed a final EIS in 2015 and feasibility report. And they're in a hurry to complete the record of decision, essentially the secretary's signature, and for the secretary to make a feasibility determination that the project is feasible before January 1st, 2021, i.e. in a couple months from now, or a month and a half. So that's, you know, they're racing for that deadline, and that's a deadline that's enables that project to qualify to be grandfathered in as a wind project, a special authorization created by Senator Feinstein to kind of get the reclamation storage program moving again. So that's their deadline, and they had two reasons to do this, and one was to do an EIS that they believe will get them out of at least some of the permits that are required, ordinarily would be required, that they would have to get from the state of California, who by law cannot issue them permits. Mm-hmm. By state law.
Yes.
And so, you know, if they get around that permitting requirement, then, you know, that's some more permits that they don't have to get, that they can't get. And the other thing is to kind of erase the rather embarrassing parts of Chapter 25 of the final EIS, which is a fairly extensive discussion about the McLeod River and the a little detail that it's like illegal under state law to move this project forward, and so and that it's kind of got some federal law problems too. And so that was in the final EIS that the Obama administration prepared, and that was just too much. So they decided to rewrite that section to eliminate many, but not all, of the disturbing admissions that had been made back in 2015. And so they did that. And, you know, there was, I think I offered almost 100 pages of comments. I carefully reviewed the supplemental EIS final, and I noted that they had, you know, reported that they had read those comments, and their response was non-responsive, mm-hmm. As it was to essentially all of the critical comments. So, you know, we didn't get an honest response. We got the party line from the Trump administration, as you might expect.
Is there any hope that a Biden administration might be able to reverse some or all of this?
Well, we'll see. First of all, the Trump administration does need to complete the process, and the process would be signing a record of decision. And once that's done, the Trump administration may believe that it can move the project forward. And you noticed that there were comments from Republican congressmen who, you know, who were self-congratulatory and we're looking forward to the project being constructed in either administration. And the Sacramento Bee over the weekend also, or the long weekend, had a story with even more folks expressing confidence that this project still had a future. Mm-hmm. And we'll see. Yeah. We'll see. I mean, there's a lot of obviously the fact that the Attorney General of the state of California said the project was illegal and went to court saying it was illegal is going to be a political impediment for the Biden administration and for the future junior senator of mm-hmm. California, who may or may not be sympathetic to Senator Feinstein's general friendly attitude towards new dams or expanded dams in the state of California. So we'll have to see what our Senate delegation wants to do. It is clear that Congressman Huffman, who at least in this Congress was the chair of Reclamation's authorizing subcommittee, is opposed to the project, if only because it's illegal, which is a good reason after all, and has not been a friend of it in the House. So we'll see. And they may be playing a long game here too. I mean, Westlands especially knows how to play a long game, and they may figure that Biden administration's just a 4-year blip in their progress on this project.
We're on a bit of a short time leash tonight on Ecotopia. We really want to thank you, Ron Stork, for being with us. Maybe we could chat again in January when there is more news on both of these projects. Your critique will be out, as well as getting some thoughts about what happened January 1st with the Trump approval. Our guest has been...
Sounds good.
Okay. Ron Stork is Senior Policy Advisor, Friends of the River in Sacramento. We'll post their website on our website, but do just check it out. Google Friends of the River Sacramento, and you can keep up with a lot of it. Thank you very much, Ron, for being with us.
You're welcome.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We'll take a short break and be back with Susan's interview with Christy Seashore about the Celebration Market.
Dale a tu cuerpo alegría, Macarena, que tu cuerpo pa' darle alegría y cosa buena. Dale a tu cuerpo alegría, Macarena. Hey, Macarena.
Hey, Macarena, Macarena, Macarena. Hey, put the chopper on the nigga, turn him to a sprinter. Hey. Bitches on my dick, tell him give me 1 minute. Hey, Macarena. Hey, Macarena, Macarena, Macarena. Put the chopper on a nigga, turn him to a sprinter. Oh. Bitches on my dick, tell him give me 1 minute. Hey, Macarena. Hey, Macarena, Macarena, Macarena. Bitches on my stick, but my name ain't Harry Potter. Nope. She lick it up, make it disappear like Tata. Wow. She asked for some dollars, not a bitch getting out of. Yeah. And I'm in this bitch for my click. Why? Click. I'ma throw 20 racks on a bitch. Why? Bitch. Three why? Phones on my lap. Ay. World on my back. Bye. She gon' be tapped in if a nigga tap. Tap it. You look like someone that I used to know. Used to. Undefeated with the bitches, I'm invincible. Diamond said invisible. Nigga, I ain't been a Jew. Want me to be miserable, but I can never miss a hoe. Hey, Macarena, Macarena, Macarena. Put the chopper on a nigga, turn him to a sprinter. Bah. Bitches on my dick, tell him give me 1 minute. My man. Hey, Macarena. Hey, Macarena, Macarena, Macarena. Go. Put the chopper on a nigga, turn him to a sprinter. Boom. Bitches on my dick, tell him give me 1 minute. Hey, Macarena. Hey, I find a spot, then I post up. Bitches wanna know if I'm single, tell her yes, sir. And I see you dance on the gram, tell her shake some. I ain't even gon' lie, I'ma eat the chonch.
My guest is Christy Seashore. She is a local artist and a part of the Wellspring Art Collective. So we're here to learn more about the Wellspring Art Collective and to find out about an event that's coming up in a week and a half, something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Like welcome, Christy. It's yeah. Nice to see you.
You too.
So what is the Wellspring Art Collective?
Well, we are a newer organization of older artists, I would say. There are 5 of us coming together. We are from a variety of arts and education backgrounds. And specifically, it's myself, Jean Christofferson. She does a lot of theater and arts and dance in the community. There's Tatiana Allen, Sierra Chick McNeil, and Ava Moon. And we are coming together to create a space that will serve what we think is an underserved population in our community, basically by offering a space that will increase participation in a variety of art practices. We all have different specialties in our lives, and we want to create a space that we can just increase participation by offering dance and studio rentals, workshop spaces, and just to serve a safe place for people to feel like they can express and practice arts that just primarily focusing on people from socioeconomic and culturally diverse backgrounds. That's kind of the general scope of what we'd like to do. We're working on obtaining a space perhaps between 2,500 and 3,000 square feet. And hopefully that will come in the spring. And then we'll be able to host kind of events and all kinds of things. So kind of a brief synopsis.
So can you say a little bit more about the art that the artists do? You said someone is a dance theater person. Can you maybe just talk a little bit more about that?
That's Jean Christofferson. She's been teaching at the college, the university, for 30 or more years. She's well-traveled. She teaches a variety of dances in the community. She serves a lot of different culturally diverse populations. She's just such a, I would say, wellspring of knowledge and experience that is really, I really think, needed in this, in our community. She does Unplugged Arts every summer, which she takes about 20 youth up into the hills, and they unplug for a week and they create a performance, and they just completely get enmeshed in the process of putting on a theater production. So that's one of the main things we want to explore in our space, is how to incorporate that kind of play. It's really important for our community to play, and as a healing, yes. A way to heal through so much of what we've already experienced prior to Corona.
And, yes.
And what will happen, there will be a huge need after, once we start being able to move freely again. Yeah.
And could you say a little bit more about the other artists and their work, you in particular? Next.
Well, I've spent 12 years with Chicoco, and we're just on a brief break from some of our larger projects, but I come from a fashion arts performance background, and then fine arts as well. So I'm seeking to explore offering that kind of thing, teaching fiber arts and production, you know, for people interested in that. And then the other women in the collective are also fiber and visual artists, graphic designers, who would be offering workshops. And then another thing we'd like to be able to do is allow some of our youth in our community to offer classes that they would like, kind of Skillshare type thing. So there's a lot of ideas rolling around, and there's probably another good five major artists in the community that have also expressed interest in teaming up with us. So we have a large following already, kind of gearing up for whenever we get our space to settle.
Nice. Great.
Yeah.
And you are one of the sponsors, the Wellspring Arts Collective, of the Celebration Market that will be coming up on December 11th and 12th. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Tell us about the Celebration Market.
So this market is a market that we are working with Turkey Tail Farms to put on. And it's primarily, looking at my notes to be sure that I'm really communicating everything. It's intended to support local producers and artists to sell our work, you know, like most craft fairs are. So we wanted to come together as the teaming up part, because it's a huge endeavor to put on a craft fair, especially during this time.
Yes.
So this year it's going to be at the Elks Lodge, and we are really actively working to be sure we're in compliance with all of the COVID protocols. And that's a huge team effort for everyone. And it's required us as organizers and the vendors to be very flexible, to just be sure everyone's safe for most. And then we are supporting the artists in the community. So that I do you want me to go into the specifics over there?
Yeah, we'd like to know a little bit more about what kinds of things people will find when they come there. And then we'll also talk about the virtual shopping in just a minute. But if they come to the market, first of all, what will they find in terms of things that are available?
Well, we have
Many vendors?
We have a 25 to 30 vendors. Some vendors share booth spaces. And there is a variety of really well-crafted artisan jewelry, fine foods, toys, kids crafts, pieces, you know, apparel, hula hoops, all kinds of varieties of things. What else am I missing? Health and beauty products, especially. And then there's always surprises, you know, lots of surprises that people pull out at the last minute, and they're wonderful and exciting. We'll also be having some, Chico Chai, I believe is, participating along with some, food truck vendors, out in the parking lot. So yeah, that's who I can think of off the top of my head.
It's a very large space too. One of the things that you've emphasized, and Samantha Zangrilli from Turkey Tail has emphasized, that you're really working to be COVID safe. And the space at the Elks Lodge is huge. It's like 7,000 square feet, I think, something like that. And so it'll be really easy to socially distance. Of course, masks will be required. What else are you doing to make sure that this is really a safe place for people to do their shopping?
Well, from the outset, we're regulating, like most places, you know, the large retail stores, regulating ins and outs. So, you know, one point of entry for in and out. We are having, we've hired staff to be sure that everything gets sanitized regularly, and we have people counters, so the little, you know, ticket people counter machines. We're working to be sure that we're in compliance with the 25% retail sales requirement. So the that's about 88 people at a time in the space. Nice thing about the Elks is that it's got a lot of variety of spaces. So we will have some indoor vendors who wish to be indoors, and then we'll also have people vending outside on the back patio and in the parking lot as well. There's a little hang there. So there is a lot of variety for people who wish to be, you know, warm and cozy inside and then outside as well. And the space inside itself we'll be using is actually about 4,000 square feet.
Oh, 4,000. I misspoke. Sorry.
It'll be only for a portion of our vendors, and everything's mapped out. So there's 6 feet between each booth space, and then there's 9 feet walkways. And then we have the sanitation stations. Everyone's with masks and sanitizers. And all the vendors are very well rehearsed in their work. So they know how to practice safety, and you know, everyone wants to keep, you know, we want to keep each other safe and supported. So,
Yeah, so that's where we are at this point with the physical shop.
And I've read a little bit about this, that there will be the potential for virtual shopping. How will that work?
So at this point, our plan is on Sunday, about 2 o'clock, we'll be turning on our Facebook Live shop. That's linked in from our 2020 Celebration Market Facebook event page. So you can go to Facebook and find the event, and we will be broadcasting live from that place. At that point, we will be using online purchase options such as Venmo and PayPal to sort of offer like sort of a live auction type thing where people can, connect with directly into the page by commenting of specific things they'd want to purchase. In addition, we are working with other vendors who might have, who also have Instagram shopping options where you can purchase an item directly from that shop that when it's live as like a product item. So I would say at this point, the best option is to just stay connected to our event page, and we will be updating all the information that the week of the market. So starting Monday, we'll be kind of giving all the information so everyone knows how to participate in whatever way they want to.
So for your Facebook event page, there'll be like pictures of the things that people are offering, and people can like tag those and contact you somehow and say, I would like to have 3 hydrosols and 2 dresses.
We're working on a couple different models of it right now, and because everything's fluid and we're kind of
flying
pants in some ways, we'll have that all clarified on the Facebook event page by the beginning of next week.
We'd
like to, because there are different ways people prefer to shop virtually, and some are easier than others, and we are addressing that with just trying to kind of pick the one that works best for everyone who's still participating at the time. So we're pretty good at navigating all the hoops this point, but we definitely want to prioritize the virtual option and minimal contact shopping as well by having outside booths. So that's where things are.
So people can go to the Facebook page, which is just Celebration Market Chico, or how will they find it?
It's 2020 Celebration Market.
2020 Celebration Market on Facebook. And starting on Monday, they'll be able to get the details of how they can shop virtually.
Yes,
and they'll also get details. They have details there of the vendors who are participating, so people can learn more about what's going to be at the market?
Yes. In fact, we're planning to post a sort of a version of a catalog, not with specific links that you can purchase this item, but to show the variety of actual things that will be there so people can kind of prepare themselves to know who they would like to shop from and, how to do that.
That's good. That helps people be organized in advance of going to the market and knowing kind of where they're headed. Ordinarily, it's really fun to browse and browse and browse and browse and browse and spend hours. But yes, since there are only a limited number of people allowed in at one time, it might be helpful to be more kind of focused in your shopping. Not that we don't want people to browse, because we do, but they can also be organized in that browsing. So can you give us again the details of when and where? And I don't think we know what the hours are either.
So at this point, it's at the Elks Lodge, Manzanita Place. I want to double check my... got my
my itinerary here. I have the right thing. The Manzanita Place, Elks Lodge. I will have to find that address again here.
It's I have it. It's 1705 Manzanita Avenue. So the Elks Lodge is almost when you get to Upper Bidwell Park.
Yes. And it's next weekend, the Saturday and Sunday. We are planning at this point to be opening the doors at 10 on both days. And depending on if the weather stays well, we'll be going till at least 4 o'clock, three or four o'clock. Again, the solid information will be available on Monday, just after we, you know, are aware of all the protocols in place for our community. So again, it's next weekend at the Elks Lodge, and bring your mask. And, you know, we will give as much information beforehand as possible. But, you know, everyone's still very excited and on board. We've got a lot of vendors who've been creating stuff, and we're, you know, moving forward to support everyone who wants to be there, so virtually, physically.
So health products, beauty products, food, toys, clothing.
Some apparel. Yep, we do have some apparel. We have people are offering home furnishing type things.
Oh, nice.
We have one of our vendors who creates bike furniture made out of bicycle parts. Quite a variety of items.
Right. So, and 25 to 30 vendors, that's gives you a pretty good choice.
Nice. Definitely, yes. And so, we also have kids. I believe that there's going to be kids creating their work as well, which a lot of our kids are very excited about participating. Great. The other thing we're going to be offering is little kids craft kits. So the kids can, you can take something for kids to create with at home and, you know, extend the experience of creativity.
Nice. So my guest has been Christy Seashore. She's a local artist and one of the members of the Wellspring Art Collective, who are co-sponsoring with Turkey Tail Farm the Celebration Market next weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And I really wish I could come.
It's cool to have your items there too.
Thank you. Thanks, Christy. Christy Seashore, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, you guys. Take care.
You too.
Squares my room, and it's
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We're also now available by podcast. Check us out at Anchor, Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast sites. Stay tuned. Next up, Radioactive with Ginger Nichols.
Weave me the sunshine out of the falling rain. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again. Sing it with me. Sunshine.